Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You may call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show also simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like the CrimeWire team to consider your case on a suspicious death, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome tonight. On Sunday, we formally announced the formation of the CrimeWire Investigative Bureau, providing investigative resources for those cases in which we believe there is a reasonable chance of the case being solved. This new initiative will involve establishing and utilizing an investigative network of private and forensic investigators and legal experts. These investigative consultants will conduct the research and make the inquiries necessary to develop sufficient information for the authorities to move these cold, stalled, or never investigated cases forward. The families will incur nominal charges for expenses, such as copying, postage, and other out-of-pocket costs. The amount of these charges will vary on a case-by-case basis. Services will include profiling the case on three different radio shows, organizing and reviewing case files and documents, conducting interviews, and bringing the case to the attention of the media and prosecuting authorities. The criteria for selecting cases to receive investigative resources will be determined in large part upon the existence of solubility factors and the commitment of family members to pursue that case. You can email us with questions at thecrimewire@gmail.com or simply visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Take it away, Denny Griffith.
In our show on February 15th, we profiled the unsolved murder of Eric Cross. The then 16-year-old was murdered in Vicksburg, Michigan on June 26, 1983. According to Eric's sister, Jackie Cross Mitchell, although witnesses named Eric's killer, no arrests have been made in this nearly 28-year-old case. Joining us again tonight for the full hour to continue discussing the case are Eric's sister, Jackie Cross Mitchell, and Kalamazoo Gazette reporter Rex Hall. Jackie and Rex, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having
us.
And we'll be taking calls during the show at 646-478-0982. That's 646-478-0982. And you can also make comments or ask questions to our chat room. Jackie, to refresh our listeners' memories here, would you please tell us a little bit about your brother?
Yes, well, Eric and our family had just moved to Vicksburg 1 year before he was murdered. We moved there in 1982 from the east side of Michigan, and he was getting ready to be a junior at Vicksburg High School. And he told my dad he was going over to his friend's house, and then instead of staying there, he ended up going to a party. And then when he left the party, there's about a four-hour time frame when we're not sure what happened to him. There's a lot of different reports and rumors and that kind of thing, but he was murdered. And my dad found him when he went out to get the Sunday Kalamazoo Gazette on Sunday morning at 5:30 in the morning. He found him lying in the road in just a horrible condition. And there have been six persons of interest. One of them has died since the murder, but the police have always focused on these same people. All the stories, all the tips that came in to Silent Observer, everything has always led back to these people. Three of them took a lie detector. All three of them failed the lie detector. One of them escaped a lot of questioning because his dad put him in a mental hospital the day after he confessed to another person that he killed, Eric. So it's been a long saga. The cold case team in Kalamazoo worked actively on the case from 2000 to 2003, and they made a lot of progress, but then budget cuts made that cold case unit go away, so then it got put back on the shelf, and then just last summer, it got active again, and one reason is because the brother of one of the persons of interest went to the police and said, you know, my brother was involved in this murder. And
who was that?
That was John. And
okay, and John is on the line with us now. John, okay. Martin is on the line here on the show.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Hi, Jackie.
You know, John, what, you know, you've known this information for a long time, haven't you?
No, actually, you know, to be honest with you, Jackie and I had talked about this. The first time I called her, I asked her to call me. I told her who I was. And for the better part of 27 years, my brother just said he didn't do it. And, you know, he's my brother, and I'm obligated to believe that. I mean, I had no reason to think that he did. And over the period of those years, that group of friends, that the core group of people were the group of my best friends, these people, I was with them every day that summer, even after this happened. And I've told the detectives and I've told Jackie, so the oddest part of this is it was never spoken of, not one time. And what had happened was I was supposed to go to the party that day. I met Eric about 12 hours before he was murdered. I met him at Ramona Park, and he was with another gentleman that was in the core group. And they stopped up to see me, and they asked if I was going, and I said yes. Well, I got in trouble that day, and I couldn't go. I was 17. My dad said I wasn't going anywhere. My older brother, who at the time was near 25, he was 24, so he was the adult in the group. He went with them, and I remember being very angry with him, and he went. What was never discussed, and what happened was there were three times particularly that I had asked Tim if he, you know, did you have any involvement in this, and he absolutely said, I don't know anything about it, anything else, so I believe that. Now, a couple years ago, it's probably been about 2 years now, my sister, during the cold case thing, he had said something to me about a piece of evidence, and I can't really discuss that, what it was, but he had said something about a piece of evidence to me because I went in and talked to these people because I didn't know anything. I wasn't there. I'd never had any facts. And so I went in and talked to him. When I left the meeting with the cold case team, I called my brother and I said, you need to go talk to these people. They're asking around about you. And he got incredibly angry and irate with me. And you know, he was being framed. I'm like, dude, you didn't have anything to do with it. Just go talk to him. Then he calmed down, as if he realized what he was doing, and he went in and talked to him. This is back in 02. Well, at this point, he said something to me about a piece of evidence that he had disposed of. And the detective had told me, too, this past summer that he'd never denied that. He had disposed of this piece of evidence without any argument. And he just wouldn't explain why. But what happened was a couple years ago, my sister and I started to see some behavioral changes in him. Very, you know, just not the guy that we knew, that the brother that I loved. And don't get me wrong, I mean, this is a guy I never thought did any wrong. But what happened is his behavioral changes started to bring up his, you know, it's like, you know, my sister and I started going, you know, I'm not so sure that, you know, we started thinking back on it, and I started thinking back to this piece of evidence, and I started thinking about different things he had said. And my sister and I talked about this for about 10 months before I ever called. I called the detective last July, or June, late June or early July. And I just said, I think you guys need to look at this again, because at this point my sister and I had, you know, checked enough of our notes together that it's like, you know, I think he had something to do with this.
And I don't want to interrupt you too much, John, but I just want to say the piece of evidence is what we think was the murder weapon. And,
yes,
and the police think that is possible, too. Because for new people, they tried to make it look like a hit and run, but it became obvious that it was not. So that's
right.
That's what the piece of evidence is. Okay.
Right. And so this had happened, and I kept going back to that in my mind. And I'm like, because when he told me he had disposed of this, he had been under an investigative subpoena at one point, and he told me that he had disposed of this item. And my first reaction, I said, why would you do that? I mean, it didn't make any sense. He told me I had to clean the trunk of the car out and this and that. I'm like, I said, you know, they called me in 3 days after it happened and, you know, questioned me too, just like everybody else in Vicksburg. But I didn't go out going, oh, no, I got to clean the trunk of my car out, you know, because I'm going to talk to the police about this kid that got killed. So that started to resonate with me. So it was really in the past 24 months that my sister and I started talking about it, but it was this last summer where I came to the conclusion that without a doubt – he certainly was there and certainly knew exactly what happened from beginning to end. At that point in time, I didn't know what the level of his involvement was, but I've come to this point where I honestly believe he's directly involved. We've talked to him about immunity. We've talked to him about, you know, getting an attorney, work out, give him your side of the story if you didn't do anything. And he will not accept any help, and he literally has that attitude that he will go to his grave with this. He's admitted to other people. The police have interviewed those people. He's admitted it, you know, to other members of my family. One of the things he said was, I saw what happened to that poor kid, but he absolutely will not. And I said to Jackie, I said it hurts me and it concerns me that he won't go forward. Because he was directly involved, he can't give them any information. You know, he wasn't a bystander. He wasn't in the wrong place at the wrong time. So this is when, you know, I had called and talked to the detective, and we just started talking about it. And he told me about another piece of evidence that he had thrown out at the same time he disposed of the first one. And I didn't know anything about that. But you know, the detective and I talked again today at length about a few things. It's a very active case. It is not sitting on a shelf. And him and I have talked probably a dozen times in the last 2 or 3 weeks about different things and cars and people. And, you know, I'm just trying to help. I know what happened to her brother, and it's horrific. And Jackie and I have a very unique relationship in that aspect because I think the world of her, and I think that's mutual. I just want to help her and her family get closure. So does my sister, and we're working very hard to do that.
Vito, can I ask you while John is talking, is this possible? And I know that your brother either is probably listening right now or will be
probably
listening. Okay, so, you know, it's not – if he could take this under consideration, if there's a way for him to go ahead and do something with the information and put it someplace. Even though you can't keep this and go to your grave with this, like he said, all you're doing is punishing other people. And like you said, you worked with him to try to come forward. You've worked with the detectives. You know, people know that he has this information. And when there's a murder, you never get over it. You remember every single moment, sound. It just doesn't go away.
Oh,
and
I'm sure.
If there's it doesn't. And if there's some way, if he's listening right now, if there's some way where he could, you know, we do these evidentiary abuse affidavits where I could change it up and blindly send it to you, and he could get it someplace that if he were hit by a car tomorrow, that information would go to his grave and this case wouldn't be solved the way that it needs to be solved. He's not the only one responsible for
that. I never thought about that because I had just heard that today about another murder in our area, the Doug Stewart murder, that he was talking about putting something in his will about where her body was. So they could actually do something like that, that it wouldn't be
This is the evidence of abuse affidavit, and what he would do, and again, if he's listening, and it stays right here with me, it doesn't go anywhere. If he emailed me at murphymilano@gmail.com, I do these all the time. Mm-hmm. I'll send him a document. He gets it videoed. He can do it from his camera. He can go to the library and do it. Put it in a safety deposit box or a safe place or in his will, say where it's at. But at least you will have closure. Your brother will have justice. And the loyalty to the other two guys who are involved, it ain't worth it. But if he is worried about that, then, you know, and nobody understands what he's also going through. I mean, he's going through, his mind is different from when that happened. Plus, it's not an excuse, it's an observation. He was a child. He was a teenager when this happened.
Absolutely.
You have to look at the year, the town, you know, I'd swear on this air, but I won't, but the mentality of that, the mentality of, you know, I'm working another murder case in another state, same thing is going on, where you got these kids, and I'm seeing firsthand from the beginning of the onset of what a family goes to. Does your brother have kids?
Yes, he does.
Okay.
And he has no relationship with him.
Okay. If he has a good relationship?
No, none.
Okay.
And I think this is a part of what haunts him.
It does. You know, it when things take place like this in our lives, we can't function. We can't talk. We can't walk. We are paralyzed by events, and it's very difficult. And how would he feel? I know that he probably doesn't have a relationship with his children, but if something happened to them just like Eric Cross, how would he feel if he knew or sensed something and that was his child, he gave birth to that child and couldn't bring that child justice? Because that's what you want. And regardless of whether together or not, your brother, you know, he always wants them to be safe and good. And, yeah, his mind is screwed up because of this one event robbed him of everything. But he has to think about what he robbed Eric Cross and what he robbed Jackie of. And what he, you know, the father went to his grave in 2007 fighting and just wanting to know, you know, justice. That's all this is about. And I think that there's a way that can be worked out. Vito, you know, jump in here as a law enforcement officer. This is kind of a rare situation, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it definitely is. But one thing we all need to understand, and John, you too, see, your brother, one thing we're not talking about, your brother is also in danger right now because, you know, the pot is really stirring right now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
we're on
nationwide radio. You are his brother. You and your sister have gone to the police. I'm sure everybody and their mother knows this by now, okay? Now, there's also a factor, just like in organized crime that I worked, where the other bad guys start to say, hey, man, we better do something because he's eventually going to go forward and do something here. So there's a danger, number one, on that. Okay, number two, will he get immunity? No, of course not. He won't get any kind of full immunity or anything of that nature. But it would behoove him to, if he is, let's say, the least culpable of three or four or five or whatever, to go forward and tell the whole story. Because now, eventually, this case is going to break. It's going to break, and probably, I would hope and pray, before this year is out. So, number one, he has a danger on his life, and I'm telling you, that is a definite danger. Number two, they're all going to wind up getting arrested. Okay, so why not at least go forward, get the best kind of a deal? You were a kid at the time. Get the best kind of a deal that you can and spill the beans and tell the truth and go forward with that. And just maybe. See, in other words, the whole key here is who's the least culpable. There's always one person that's usually the least culpable out of the whole group. Okay, maybe it was him. Maybe he's the most culpable. But either way, it's time for him, since he's already telling your sister, he's going through all kinds of major problems in his life. He needs to put this to rest. And I commend you and your sister for what you're doing. It's obviously a tremendously tough, tough situation, a family situation. To go, I can't even imagine. I mean, this is your brother. But you're doing, you know, you've stepped out and say, I got to do what I have to do here. And you know, we're going to go forward, and we got to put this to rest. There's a grieving family that has not had closure. So that's the things we're looking at here, Susan. There's also a very big chance of some repercussion against this individual.
Well, actually,
you know?
For tonight's show, if you think about it, because everybody that was involved in that murder that night, with all these guests that I'm just looking at and those that we can't see, chances are, Denny, right, they're all listening right now, all that were involved.
I would suspect you're right. I would suspect they're out there and listening to what the people are saying, what John is saying, and what Jackie had to say, and what we're commenting on. Rex Hall, can I bring you into this a minute? From what your knowledge of this case and what you're hearing tonight, I don't know if this is anything new to you or if you're all familiar with it. What is your sense as a non-family or non-friend observer in this, of the solvability of this case? Do you think, like it seems to us, that this is almost there, that it's close?
I certainly get that sense, and I think just like John said, it's not a case that's just sitting on the shelf. It's definitely active. You know, the thing that I, or the sense that I get about the case is that there is this sort of this code of silence between those that were involved, and you know, there's cases here in our area that have occurred that were similar to Eric's case that finally, after years and years, were solved because someone in that group that stayed silent for so long finally broke and told the police what they knew. And I think, you know, based on the discussions that I've had with the lead investigator in this case, that's the one thing that they don't have right now that they really want and they really feel like they need in order to get this case to a point of resolution.
Hey, Jackie.
Jackie, yes?
Can I ask you one question here, and just going through the notes and everything on the story here? The party that your brother was at that night,
yes.
Do you know about how many people were at that party?
I think what they thought is there was like between 100 and 150 people. It was a big party, and it became bigger, I think, than it was supposed to be. They passed out invitations at school, but then other people came that weren't invited, and the parents bought kegs and charged the kids to get in. So, yeah, it became kind of an out-of-hand party, so it was pretty big. Yeah, a lot of people were there.
And the reason I'm asking you that is because on my notes here it says he left the huge gathering at 1 a.m., possibly after he was involved in an altercation. Well, I'm sure as an ex-detective on a police department with 100 or more people there, I would know for sure if there was an altercation or not. I mean, have you ever found that out for sure?
Well, we know of one altercation is very well documented. That was between Eric's good friend, and whose name was Bill, and other people at this party. They definitely fought. Many people saw that they all got kicked out of the party. The next thing that we don't know exactly what happened is, before we'd always saw Eric walked home by himself, but then recently it's been said that possibly he got into the car with those persons of interest. But regardless, this altercation made them all get kicked out of this party. But Eric was not directly involved in that first altercation that ended the party. But then, you know, he definitely had, his injuries were just so massive. I mean, his jaw was broken in many places. He had a black eye. His leg was broken. His spleen was punctured. He had lacerations, burns, rope burns. And the other boy, who was supposed to be his friend, also had bruises all over him. So recently it's come out, you know, that he was fighting, that the friend did fight Eric over a girl. It's always been said it was over a girl. So there was, you know, one fight that was well documented, another fight that is kind of mysterious because we know that, you know, he was beaten up. We know one of the persons of interest said they tied a rope around him and dragged him, tied it to the bumper and dragged him.
Had a rope around Eric and dragged him?
Right, yeah, yeah. That was the confession that was made to another individual, and the individual who heard the confession went to the police, you know, right away. That was in December of 83, and that person who heard the confession took a lie detector, passed the lie detector, said, this is what he told me. He said that he tied a rope around Eric's chest, tied it to the bumper of his car, and dragged him around the block. So what we don't know, and a lot of his injuries were post-mortem. Then they took him back to our house and ran him over several times there. So we don't, you know, because that was to try to make it look like a hit and run after they'd already done all these other things. So, you know, we don't, that's the thing. I mean, like you said, we just want to know, and my dad died without knowing what happened to him, because especially people who I know are listening that are families of murder victims, you just wonder what your loved one's last moments were like. Why did he die? Was there any purpose to it? Did he say any, have any last words? Did he suffer? How long did he suffer? We don't know the answers to any of those things. And so I don't think it's fair to make someone wait for three decades just to find out,
and John,
keep wondering about that.
That's right. And John, your brother has to have a lot of compassion for, you know, there's no good side to this, but for some reason, they at least brought him back to his house. In many of these murder cases, and Rex, I'm sure you'll agree, and Denny and Vito, they're missing persons. No one finds the bodies, and they don't get a proper burial. They don't get to be brought home.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason in this crime, and I find it very interesting that these individuals kind of brought him home. What's everybody's thought on that?
I don't, you know, there's a part of me that thinks that's incredibly sick. In the condition he was in,
every other case I've ever seen, they throw them in the river. They get rid of them.
Right.
We can't find them. I'm saying that in some kind of a sick way.
And I agree that, you know, it's good that Jackie and I talked about that today, and she said, you know, at least we have a body, because we were talking about another case that they don't have the body, they don't have a grave to go to, and you know, and I told Jackie today, I said it to me. And to my sister, in talking with her and my father, I mean, it's unconscionable that there's this many people that are able to lie about this, that are able to go on with their life and live their life after having done this to a 16-year-old kid. And the thing that really struck me when the first time that I talked to Jackie, I assumed the Facebook page started because I had talked to the detective back in the early or the middle of the summer, around June, July. And so I saw that Facebook page, and I think I was, I don't know, friend number 30 or 40, somewhere in the low numbers. And so I assume she started the page because the investigation was kicked up again. And when she called me, we talked for a few minutes, and I said, well, when was the last time you talked to Rich Madison? And she said, 2002. And I said, really? So it was coincidental that she started the page, and my sister and I had went to the detectives with this and talk to them, but it's the fact, I mean, what we know, there's not a dime-sized spot of doubt for the people that have the information that we have of who's responsible for this. I mean, there's no question, and there's no question to me that my brother's directly involved in this, and we've tried, and believe me, and I don't know if it was Vito or Denny we're talking to, he won't even talk to us anymore. I mean, he told my sister the last time, don't call me again, because we have tried and tried and tried to reach out to him, and we have tried to appeal to his moral sense, you know, and it's every one of them, and it's not just these core group of people, there's people they have told. There's people that know this, that live with this every day, and I cannot fathom how somebody can live with this and
that's
and try and raise
when you
their
know
kid.
Something when you
absolutely.
Harbor, I mean, it's a crime, and that's and Vito or Denny speak to that, because that's important, isn't it?
Go ahead, Denny.
Let me just I wanted to say something, Susan, not directly to answer your question, but while I've been listening here, I've been thinking, and I want to go back to the evidentiary abuse affidavit. And I'm just thinking, if John's brother has any moral sense, as we're calling it, that doing something like that, and obviously we just soon have him call Detective Madison tonight, okay? But in lieu of that, at least preserve the story. Preserve the story. So if you say if something happened, he had run over by a car tomorrow or something, someone eventually will be able to get the word out of exactly what happened that night.
But Denny, it's also not him, though.
Yeah.
It's everybody that knows information that we're starting to use this in, Denny, because you and I have been doing it, in cases where people know something or think they do, or they saw a crime happen and they put this on there because they're afraid to come public. But what if when they're ready, they accidentally die? You know, it's
exactly
important.
And John, let me ask you a question, if I could. You say your brother indicated that he would take this information to the grave with him. Do you know the reason? What loyalty or what does he owe the other people, or what is his logic that he
I think his logic, quite simply, is he's going to go to prison for the rest of his life. And that's I mean, I think to be very blunt about it, that's exactly what he's scared of. And it's incredibly selfish for us. You know, I mean, to me, that's the most selfish thing. I mean, it's, you know, you weren't 16 or 17 like these kids. You were 24. And I remember the first time I talked to Jackie, and she said to me, and I'd never thought of it from this angle, but she said, you know, my mother was always so hurt that there was an adult there that couldn't stop this. And that was the first time I'd thought of it from that angle. And I started thinking about my group of friends. And I started thinking about my brother that's 7 years older than the oldest one. And I'm going, you're absolutely right. And I know he could have stopped that whole group from doing anything. I mean, he was very capable of taking care of himself. And there's no way that group of people could have overpowered him or made him watch or anything else. And that was the first time I'd thought of it like that. It's like, you were the adult, you know, and we tried to appeal to him. Just, I mean, you know, there's so much pain involved with this for my, especially with my parents. I mean, you know, my father's a pastor. We were not raised like this. And as I said to Jackie today, I said, this has to do with making one bad decision on one day of your life to go out drinking with a bunch of underage kids, which is something that everybody listening needs to keep in mind for their kids. Think about the decisions you make. That was one night, one decision, and this is what the outcome was.
Yeah, you know, what John – go ahead, Denny.
Yeah, I was just wanted to finish up. So what you're saying, John, if I understand you, is in the case of your brother, he's not really trying necessarily to protect somebody else's friends. He's got his own interests in mind that
– Oh, absolutely.
He was involved enough that he could take a pretty good fall for this.
Oh, absolutely. He's not going to take a fall for anybody. I mean, he's not protecting anyone.
But he's also not going to be responsible for his actions. What do you say to that, Vito, when somebody doesn't kind of man up and doesn't take responsibility for their actions?
Well, you know, we can all sit here and say that, but John brought up a good point, so you have to realize it. You're saying to somebody to do the right thing. Come on, man up.
Yeah,
but man up comes with going to prison for the rest of your life.
Absolutely.
So again, see, I mean, so what the point John's making is, I mean, it's very easy for us and all the bloggers and all of us to say, come on, do the right thing, which is the right way to do it. But then you see, in other words, what I'm hearing here, you know, this fella was brought up, your father's a pastor, right, John?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know, a lot of times I see three or four people commit a crime, a big crime of this nature, okay? They look at each other, they say, it doesn't go any farther than here. We never discuss it. We never talk about it. Okay? Whole problem with that logic is, as time goes by, one fella, maybe because he was brought up in a church like this kid was, has to continue to tell people, be it his brother or be it this one or that one, because he's tormented by it. Okay? But on the other hand, when you say to him, all right, come on, you need to bring it forward, man. We got to do something here. This is ridiculous. You know, put yourself on the mercy of the court, blah, blah, blah. No, I'm going to bring it to my grave because, like John, the brother, said, he's going to go to jail the rest of his life. So that's what you're dealing with here. You know, you got a tormented soul that is just, you know. So a lot of times we have to be careful. I mean, we're in law enforcement. We're in different things of that nature. We're investigators, victims advocates, and we want people to do the right thing. But, you know, it's a situation where, hey, I ain't going to do the right thing. I'm not going to go to jail the rest of my life.
That's exactly right.
When they get me, they get me. I've got 27 years on this murder already that I wouldn't have had. So, you know,
that's
we need to remember that. Right, John?
And that's, That's exactly what every one of them's thinking. They've got this much time behind them. Why in the world? And I think that's their mentality: is why in the world would I tell them now? You know, I mean. They don't realize they're in prison already.
The female who's still alive, I asked her to meet with me and a priest because I'm Catholic. I found out that she was Catholic. I asked her to meet with me and a priest, just tell me what happened, nothing to do with law enforcement, and she refuses to do that. So it's not just that they're trying to avoid you. I don't agree with that. I don't know about Tim, but this girl doesn't care. She just doesn't care. She's given up caring, and she doesn't care about our family, because if she did, she would just tell me what happened, and she could go and meet with us and a priest, and you know, and it would be confidential, and I wouldn't tell anyone else about it either. I just want to know what happened. So, you know, yes, they're looking out for their self-interest, but they also don't care. I asked her to send me an anonymous letter. I still haven't gotten the anonymous letter. You know, just tell us the story of what happened. I asked her, did he suffer? I asked her two times in the letter I wrote to her, did he suffer? Is it too much to ask to tell me that? No, he died instantly. You know, just tell me something. So, yes, they're trying to protect themselves, but they also just don't care.
They don't care.
They have died. Their souls are almost dead. When I talk to her on the phone, she talks in a monotone. They've done so much to themselves that they aren't like you and me.
No, they're a mess. They're all a mess.
Mm-hmm. They aren't.
Go ahead,
they
Daddy.
Don't talk like normal people. They aren't. They're very broken.
Go ahead, Dan.
Rex, let me ask you this: if after listening to what Jackie and John have just said, now obviously somewhere in this so-called core group or somewhere in the mix here, there's one or two people with less culpability than the others. There's got to be somebody who's just more or less a witness, happened to be there. And
that's what this female is, and they've told her. They've told her that they wanted to give her immunity. Yeah, her husband's a police officer. They've told her they just want this person. They name who they want. They want her to be a witness. They don't want to prosecute her, and she still wouldn't cooperate. So that's what eventually we started to think maybe some of them were more active. Maybe all of them were. I don't know, but there's some reason why they won't just become witnesses, and I don't for sure know why that is.
Danny, go ahead.
I was just wondering, what do you think then it would take? Any ideas what it would take to change somebody's mind here? Do you think that so much time has passed that they become kind of comfortable that, look, we got away with it for 27 and a half years? Why, like I think John said, you know, the logic, why would we want to say anything after we've beaten it for 27 or 28 years?
Right.
Do you think that's the main issue now, that so much time has gone by with nothing happening, that there's no incentive?
I think that's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, when I think about Eric's case, there was another case in our area that had some of the similar circumstances. It was a case from, I believe, 1973, if I remember correctly, but it was the Janet Chandler case in Holland, Michigan. And they finally got one of the main people in that case to crack by sitting him down in an interview room and asking him what he would feel like if someone did to his daughter what these people had done to Janet Chandler. And he finally broke and he told him what had happened and who was involved. And I don't know what it's going to take in this case. I mean, I think that's a really big question, and that's going to take some time to answer. But, you know, I think maybe you have to appeal to whatever heart they have. I mean, obviously for Jackie and for John, too, there's a question of how much heart is left there. But I think that for the police investigators, sometimes they have to try to look for that. And, you know, police investigators I've talked to who have investigated cold cases, you know, they say that no matter what, every person has some good in them. You have to try to find that, and you also have to try to see that. And a lot of times that can help you as an investigator to solve the case.
After 27 years, though, I don't know. And besides us putting the burden on Tim, who else is involved? I mean, why are we just kind of going to one person when it's more than one?
Well, Tim's the only one that I have any kind of contact or control
okay.
with, you know. I mean, because he's my, you know, he's my brother. And,
uh-huh.
you know, I had put on Facebook the other day, somebody asked who's Tim the polygraph was that was on there. And I said, that's my brother. And I said, do you know, if you don't think it was hard for me to go call the police, I mean, my sister and I talked about this in depth because it's the gravity of the situation. I mean, this we're talking about a murder. We're talking about a horrific thing. And for me to be convinced, and when the evidence, I told Jackie, I said, once the evidence started to outweigh the innocence, then there was no question in my mind what I needed to do. It's about right and wrong thinking. And I'm not going to be any part of any kind of a cover-up like this. And this, I talked to the detective Madison today, and I told him, I says, you know, I'm sure that back then my brother made it very clear to the group of my friends, this core group, these were all the people that I hung around with every day, and we were almost inseparable. And that one, I'm sure that my brother told them, don't you say a word to John about this, because he'll tell. Because there's no way that I would have lived with that. And back when the cold case team had talked to me, you know, too, you know, Detective Workema, who I happened to know, looked at me and he said, would you tell us if it was your brother? And you know, I said, you bet I would. So I'm not going to live with something like this on my mind and on my conscience and in my heart. It's I don't know how anybody can, but you know, for me it's real simple because he's the only one that I have any kind of contact or control with, you know, and I quite frankly I'm at a complete dead end. There's you know, he's backed and painted himself into a corner that so far into the corner of the basement that he can't reach the stairs if he tries with me. I mean, there's just the contradictory. And then I read the full polygraph, which wasn't on Facebook, but Jackie shared it with me. And it's a completely different story than what he's told everybody for 20 years or 27 years. And it changes every time we talk to him, with my sister also. So, you know, with me, it's real simple. I don't have any contact with anybody else. And I'm trying to use, you know, what contact I do have with somebody to try and get this resolved for her and her family. You know, and I mean, this is just killing my mother, and it's hurting her. I mean, she cries to me on the phone daily, and it's terrible, you know, and it's a sad thing, but I don't have any contact with any of these other people. I separated from those people later on that year. I moved away out of the city but I never knew anything until just a, you know, 2 years ago we started talking about it.
I think that since Donna Pendergast, who's a Crime Wire consultant, is not here and is with the Attorney General's office right there in Michigan, she's going to be listening to the show by tomorrow, and perhaps there's something that can be done. We don't have a lawyer on team tonight, but just based on this show, Vito, Denny, weigh in. There is something here, and there's enough to possibly make an arrest just on what we've talked about tonight.
You're right, Susan. There's so much on this case than other cold cases. But, you know, I wanted to ask Rex Hall, the reporter, a question. Hey, Rex, the time you've been working on this, so many years have gone by. You're dealing with individuals that had girlfriends that are no longer their girlfriends, friends that are no longer the friends of these suspects. Have you received any phone calls, any tips, anything worthwhile that you were able to pass along to the police, Rex?
I have not. I know in talking with Jackie that she has let me know that John was in a position now where he might be willing to talk to me more about his brother. And,
has that been in the paper yet? Have you reported that in the paper yet? Oh.
No, not yet.
Okay.
That's something on my to-do list, but the past 2 weeks I've been down in St. Joseph County to the south of Kalamazoo covering a murder trial down there, actually the Doug Stewart murder trial that you guys mentioned. But I do hope to talk to John more and hopefully get something in the paper, and Jackie has given me some documents to review that I also am going to take a look at and see if what they contain is something that we can get in the paper. And I think for us, this story is something that we're going to keep an eye on, we're going to keep writing about, and we're going to keep getting the word out there about it, and hopefully you know, play an indirect role in helping Jackie and helping her family.
Yeah, because, you know, now that John has gone forward and has done a great thing on his part with his sister, and this, you know, this is airing across the country with a lot of people listening to it, as well as people back in your area, of course, you know, it's out. You know, the news is out. Maybe if you're allowed or you forge ahead and you do a couple articles, maybe the phone would ring with even additional tips. But that's just my
sure.
opinion.
Yep.
And I think, like I said, we take this to because that's who was part of CrimeWire. She also happens, it's, you know, part, separate and aside from that, she also happens to be with the Attorney General's Office at State of Michigan. And I'm just thinking, based on what we did with what's been discussed, this is, you know, Denny, this is a pretty much of a no-brainer to go in and take it a step further kind of quick.
Yeah, if Donna Pendergrass can convince them of that, that would be great. Yeah, that would be great.
But if that's convincing her, all she would do is no, she happens to, she's not part of that with when she comes onto CrimeWire. She's, it just so happens that she's who I would go to because it's a coincidence. It's not.
Oh, okay.
It would just be like, here, listen, and tell me where to go, or tell Denny where to go, or tell Vito where to go, or where do we take this then? That's what I'm saying as far as a consultant capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, anything that moves us forward.
Because this seems, it's got to be frustrating, certainly for Jackie and the family and Eric's friends and so forth and the family friends. It's got to be frustrating for the police if this thing is that close. I mean, if you know, we were talking earlier about solvability factors. This seems to have that. I mean, you know, this isn't one of those cold cases where there's absolutely no evidence, no witnesses, no suspects, no nothing. That this has got, it seems, though, a very high solvability factor. And I'm wondering, Vito, let me throw this out to you, if, you know, there obviously is no weak link that we can see in this so-called core group, but I wonder if somebody mentioned earlier, I forget who it was, if somebody could be charged with a lesser crime, maybe obstructing the investigation, maybe something where somebody could be charged with something and be suddenly be facing some time or facing some legal issues. Facing the publicity of an arrest and the story getting out there, I wonder if that would loosen some tongues if these people were actually in fear for their own, and how far would they go to protect the next person up the chain?
Well, see, what you have here, why this case is so different, and you used the word, Denny, solvable, is that you have a preponderance of circumstantial evidence here. Okay, which sometimes you don't get on a case. Now, then it becomes the call of the prosecutor or district attorney, whatever they're called over there, to say, hey, are we going to go forward? It's almost 30 years. Well, do we have enough to take a shot? Man, the guy, you know, the brother knows, the sister knows, everybody's walking around town, they all know. We got, you know, a preponderance of circumstantial evidence. Are we going to take a shot with that and try to make this work or not? I believe a jury would convict them. I think there's enough of that a jury would walk away and convict them. Now, again, we have to deal with that state's laws, too, and see what the laws are in that state and the mindset of the prosecutors and the mindset of the police department. Police department, being an ex-cop, is probably saying, we don't have enough yet. The chief of detectives may be saying, we don't have enough. We need a little bit more. So, you know, it all depends on that. Is it a solvable case? Yes, it is. And I know the police would want to solve this because you're dealing with a big-time case here that, as a policeman's point of view, you would love to put that in your jacket, which means into your file, that you helped solve a 30-year-old case. So, you know, somebody's going to always want that on, you know, in their file, in their folder, in their jacket, as it's called, to solve a case of this nature. So, you know, there again, there's a lot of circumstantial stuff here, but they're probably not enough where they want to go forward with it. Because once you go forward and you lose, that's the end of it.
Right. Jackie and I just talked about that today, too. I said, because the thing I want people, especially from the area, to understand Detective Matt, this is a very active case. I mean, it's very active. He has called me more in the last probably 3 weeks than he has in the last 6 months. And it's about particulars, and it's about different details and different people that my brother and I mutually knew back then and who they were and things of that nature. And he is very active on this. And what Jackie and I talked about it today, and I said, Rich Madison, Detective Madison, happened to be a street cop at that time and happened to be on the scene. He was called in to canvass the neighborhood that morning. And people need to understand he wants this solved. This is something he has been from day one on this case in some manner, but he was not in charge of anything back then. He now is in the mode of trying to clean up what wasn't taken care of back then. If there was any mess, he's got to clean. It's all in his lap now. But he wants this solved as badly as anybody. This is a very personal thing to him. And when I talked to him in the summer, when I first called him, I said, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there and see anything. I don't have any physical. I don't know anything. I mean, but you need to look at this again. Because I said, I'm telling you, I believe in my gut. At that time, I thoroughly believed. My brother was, he knows, he can tell you what happened from A to Z and everything in between. I don't think he's involved in killing him, but I'm sure that he was there and he can clear this up. And he said, Detective Madison said to me, he said, John, we've known who's done this for 27 years. We just can't get it to fall into place. None of them will talk about the other one. None of them will turn on the other. And one of the things that my brother told me in a conversation was that they had a pact. And I said, who had a pact? He said, they had a pact. I said, so let me get this straight. They had a pact that they then came home and told you about early in the morning, but not to tell anybody that they just killed somebody. Mm-hmm. It's another thing. And it's like, it was just, it's so convoluted and it's just they want this case solved, and he does, but that's one of the things he fears. You take this to trial and you lose, you're done.
But also, Jackie, was one of the witnesses, did they just recently try to commit suicide?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say, because somebody had said there wasn't a weak link. I feel like there is a weak link. Yes, one of them was transported to the hospital within the last month for a suicide attempt, and I feel like that is the weak link. So I feel like there is still a chance, for one of them to come forward, and that is one of the ones who we feel like, didn't take direct action to kill Eric. And he is also one of the ones who said in his original statement in 1983, if I tell what I know, I'm afraid of what will happen to me. So when
right.
I read that, I thought that's the one he's the only one who even was gutsy enough to say that
right.
he did know something, but he wasn't going to tell. And then he said Eric was dragged, put into a trunk, beaten up, dragged around.
Tied up.
He's tied up.
Yep.
He said that. And then he said, somebody else told me that. But he said that because he knows that, because he was there. So he I feel like there is really hope for that one. I have not directly talked to him. That's one of the only ones I haven't directly talked to, and I really want to. And that's something I'm working on because I do feel like there's hope for that one.
And this is the one that introduced me to Eric.
He should do this evidentiary abuse affidavit, definitely. If any of them should, he should. Yeah, definitely. So I never heard of that before. I definitely want to look into that. It's great.
Go ahead, Denny.
Rex Hall.
Yes.
I got a question for Rex. We've been speculating here about probable cause, and did the police have enough possibly to make an arrest or to put some extra pressure on someone? I'm just curious if what is the reputation of the DA's office there in the county? Are they aggressive? Or do they tend to really go after stuff? Are they more laid back? Or what's the general reputation or image of the DA's office?
I think depending on who you talk to, you're going to get differing opinions on how aggressive the prosecuting attorney's office is. I think that in this case, what I have been told is that I mean, at the end of the day, the decision whether to charge in a case comes down to the prosecutor's office. Obviously, the police have to make the decision to submit the case for review, but when it comes time for, you know, who to charge and what to charge them with, it's up to the prosecutor. I think you will find differing opinions about this prosecuting attorney's office depending on who you talk to, but a lot of times on cases like this, I think that when they're in a position where they feel like they're ready to charge, they're doing that because they feel like that the case is in a good position where they're going to be able to win the case, and especially on a case like this where you do only get that one opportunity.
Dan?
Okay. Yes. Yeah, that's interesting. I want to get back to that evidentiary abuse affidavit for a minute. Jackie, I hope you do follow up on that, and we're glad we mentioned it, because you said you weren't aware of it before. But if there is you know, a possibility that one of these persons that may have knowledge or may have participated at least to some degree in this thing or been there, you know, somebody needs to get this documented. Like I say, even if they don't go to the police today, at least preserve the story so that at some point the thing can be resolved. So, yeah, I do hope, you know, you consider that, and maybe that's a possibility in this, at least for this one individual.
And if anybody has any information, they need to call Detective Rich Mattson. The number is 269-383-8731. What we're going to do here at CrimeWire is we're going to do some things, but we're not going to say what they are. A lot of what we do is behind the scenes. And, you know, we hope that before that happens that somebody, you know, will anonymous tip. Is this also an anonymous tip number as well, Jackie, for people to call that you have up here?
Yeah, we have an anonymous tip.
Is it the 269-383-8731?
That's actually Detective Madison's number. So I'm getting the anonymous tip number is 313. I can't find it.
You don't have it. Okay.
It's Silent Observer. That's the program where you can call in and make an anonymous tip. It's the area code's 269-343-2100.
Oh, thank you,
and,
Rex. Thank you.
And then what's important about that is, Vito, real quick, explain what anonymous means.
Well, anonymous is, you know, just what it says. You want somebody to, like I always say, whisper it in your ear. Just call and tell us, do this, go to this location, talk to this one. Well, who's that? Just do it, and you'll see.
Well, why don't people do that? And why do they feel that, you know, with caller ID or trapping or tracing, that somebody's going to come back to them? That's what that means. That's all anybody's asking for is the tip.
That's right. That's what they want on this. And excellent show tonight, and that's why we did it again, and probably do it another time, too. I mean, we're just going to keep after this one. This is very solvable. We'll do whatever we can as the CrimeWire investigative team, the ones that are on the show tonight and the ones behind the scenes, to help do our part and get this case out.
That's right. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, and public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, March 8th, 2011. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Or to hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, please go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play.
Good night, everybody.
Remember,
good night.
We ensure
you.
That your voices will be heard. When there is nowhere else to turn, visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, and Susan Murphy Milano. And thank you very much for joining us, and good night.
Good night.
Thanks for having us.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.